Wherever you're listening, if you're in Australia, you're on Aboriginal land. At the National Film and Sound Archive of Australia, we pay respects to the elders and acknowledge their ongoing custodianship of the country where we made this podcast, and of the country you're listening to it on. For many of us growing up, there was just one reason to switch on the radio: to hear the latest hits.
Just driving around in a car, you escaped into these songs that were just waiting for you in the air.
He taught me how to make mixtapes at home. And it was all originally from listening to radio. So listening to how disc jockeys back then on air would, you know, weave in great new pop music and introduce you to this new sound coming out of somewhere around the world. So I was obsessed. It was our internet, basically, back then.
The music you listen to helped define your identity.
Growing up on Queensland's Sunshine Coast in the 1990s, it was very much about FM, very commercial, laid-back, pop rock station. And at our school, when you got to high school, you either stayed with CFM or you graduated to Triple J. You became one of the alternative kids or you became one of the norm kids.
But that intense relationship you had with your favourite station that brought you the music you wanted to hear any time of the day or night didn't always exist. It was born in the 1950s, thanks to two remarkable inventions that were inextricably intertwined. One was technological and one was cultural. They were the transistor radio and the teenager. You've tuned in to Who Listens to the Radio, brought to you by the National Film and Sound Archive. I'm Patrick McIntyre, and this is Episode 3, Wired for Sound. It's the late 1950s. The kids born in the post-war baby boom, all 5.5 million of them, are hitting adolescence. And they're doing it differently from anyone before. It's what NFSA curator Simon Smith calls a youthquake.
The youthquake coincides with both the rise of rock and roll and the start of television in Australia. And from this, we're talking of the era coinciding with post-war prosperity and the baby boomer generation, many of whom became teenagers just as the mid-1960s British invasion of beat groups began to make an impact around the Western worlds.
Unlike their parents, these teenagers, as they soon became known, were born into good times. They didn't have to quit school and get a job. They could keep studying and spend their pocket money on cool clothes, cool movies, and cool music. Torsten Kading, one of the NFSA's curators, explains.
I think there's a few different things happening at the same time there, which is often how these things work, I suppose. Some is technological, some is cultural. The cultural side is about at the end of the, or during the Second World War, and then at the end of the Second World War, the predominance of American culture. And American culture, particularly in the 50s, starts to become really around the teenager, both in terms of music and James Dean films and the like. It's that youth culture part of it and the early part of rock and roll, with obviously with Elvis, but also Australian performers as well, like Johnny O'Keefe or Cole Joy, who become really big stars at that period.
One of the essential items for every teen was the newfangled transistor radio, made of plastic, powered by batteries, and small enough to carry wherever you went. Here with a bit of science, Andy True.
Knowledge time.
Wildest new transistors ever from AWA, with a sound so big it's frightening, baby, and better reception everywhere.
Welcome to the fascinating world of transistor radios, a journey from bulky tubes to pocket-sized marvel. In 1947, the transistor was born, changing the game in consumer electronics. The Regency TR-1 hit the shelves in 1954, marking the advent of the first commercial transistor radio. Fast forward to 57, and Sony's TR-63 made transistor radios a mass market sensation, dominating the 60s and 70s as the go-to electronic communication device. So what's good about the transistor? Small, shock-resistant, and instant-on, making it a game-changer. Compare that to the hefty portable tube radios of the 50s, and you'll see why transistor radios become a global sensation. Around 1980, the scene shifted. AM transistor radios faced competition from boomboxes and the iconic Sony Walkman. As technology advanced, portable CD players, MP3 players, and smartphones took the spotlight. But the transistor's colossal impact of innovation, meeting pocket-sized convenience, reverberated through all tech that followed. Operating between 88 to 108 megahertz, FM introduced wider channel spacing, 200 kilohertz apart, significantly more spacious than AM's 10 kilohertz. This meant less interference between stations. Back to you, Patrick.
Mass-produced first in Japan, later in Australia, the transistor radio turned everything around.
What happened during the youthquake era is that the transistor radio meant that radio went from being a family group listening experience to a personalised individual listening experience. Well, you had the option to do both. And the transistor radio meant that you could take it into your bedroom, the bathroom, you could take it to parties, you could take it to the beach, you could take it anywhere, it was in your car. Instantly, music was accessible everywhere.
The transistor radio became the blueprint for all the handheld audio technology to follow. The Walkman, the Discman, the boombox, and the digital device you're probably listening to right now. But the thing is, the sound quality was not great. So record companies adapted. Companies like Motown knew their audience was tuning in on transistors, so they mixed their tracks to suit the machine's low fidelity. Around this time, the radio market divides between stations for older listeners focused on news and current affairs, and stations delivering non-stop rock and roll to insatiable teen fans. The music was exciting, and so was the chance to hear from your idols. By the 1960s, music stations have developed their own sound.
We sort of think of the rock and roll era as everyone, you know, being rowdy and out there, but really when you listen to Presley and those guys speaking, they're still very respectful to elders. They've still got that old school, well, yes, you're older, you might be square, but I'm still going to be very nice and respectful to you. You move to the 60s, that sort of dissipated. So I think the 60s was a time, obviously, of massive change culturally across everything. But in terms of radio, it was the moment that I think Australia started to sort of find their own voice a bit.
And then came an event that changed everything. The Beatles tour of 1964.
Soon as the Beatle aircraft touches down at Essendon Airport,
the Beatles coming to Australia was the biggest thing to happen to the music industry. The music industry changed overnight. There's this absurd moment where they landed in Sydney.
Hello there, Beatle fans!
The weather was atrocious. They got out a mascot. They were put into an open truck. It was almost hailing. The Beatles were laughing. So, you know, you'd never see this these days. They were laughing because the weather was so bad. They just wanted to greet the kids who'd waited out all night, who were drenched and freezing and everything. They're holding umbrellas that have gone inside out. Like, it's just that they were useless. But what happened in Australia was that radio covered the Beatles tour so heavily. And it was just such an enormous, exciting time to be in Australia, to be young. And radio covered that so well. The Australian tour just changed the music industry. The radio industry were so excited when they came out. 3UZ said to their presenters, when they come in, like in Melbourne, when they come in, we don't want you to just give a standard report. We want excitement. We want energy. So they really talked it up. It was the biggest thing to happen to Melbourne, really, probably since the Olympics.
15 miles from the city, from the airport itself. Now, Don, 15 miles from the airport itself.
Oh, thank you, Don. It's mayhem down here. There are thousands upon thousands from where I am standing.
Pandemonium started to break out a short time ago when the Fokker aircraft bearing the Beatles came into sight.
We love you, Beatles, because the aircraft is about to touch down at Essendon.
The doors will open very shortly and the Beatles will be here. Well, this is the biggest moment ever, I think, in the history of Essendon Airport. It's a fantastic day.
The Beatles were only supposed to perform in Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane, but Adelaide's three main stations decided to do something about that. They got together a petition with 80,000 signatures, and it worked. Adelaide was added to the itinerary, and when the band arrived, they were met by an estimated 300,000 people. It proved the might of a new cultural power player, the disc jockey. Listeners often felt a very personal bond with the DJs, who seemed to be talking directly to them. The top DJs soon became stars in their own right.
In the 60s, the DJ had enormous power. They invented catchphrases. They had their own fan clubs. They were sometimes had bigger fan clubs than the artists themselves. And they became extremely important. If they liked a song, they could break a song, as in they could make it popular. And people would listen to the radio, and then they would go to record shops and buy the music that they had heard on the radio. So the radio was incredibly powerful for records. The DJ, they had discs in front of them, and if they wanted to play something, they could.
The TV Week King of Pop Awards even had a category for the most popular radio presenter in each state. 3XY's Greg Evans, who would later host TV dating show Perfect Match, was so popular he took it home 6 years in a row, and his winning streak only ended when they stopped handing out that award. Big-name DJs had the power to pick the next big thing.
Someone like Stan Rofe, Stan the Man Rofe, he was the biggest name in teenage radio in the 1960s in Melbourne. So many 60s Australian music artists attribute him with their success because he would play their discs. Sometimes he would play their discs multiple times in an hour until you got used to it or until you liked it. He was a good arbiter of taste. He really pushed local talent. Bands like the Masters Apprentices, the Twilights, the Zoot, Russell Morris. These artists, they all attribute Stan Rofe to a lot of their success because in those days, radio had the power to make or break hits. In Sydney, you had someone like Ward Austin, who is sometimes known as the White Knight. He always wore white, generally white denim. He was sort of one of the most out there radio presenters. He was really hip. He had very, you know, cool speak, what you class today as cool speak and hip speak.
So when, in 1970, a spat between radio stations and record companies took hundreds of bands off the air, it wasn't just the fans that panicked, it was the artists.
So the record ban or radio ban of 1970 was one of those remarkable periods in Australian music that, through a clash of commerce between the big Australian and UK recording companies wanting radio stations to pay them for their discs that they were making. Well, the radio stations were making heaps of money from their free product, right? So the radio stations were going, well, we can't afford to pay you for the discs. We're giving you free publicity of your artists. But it led to an impasse in 1970 for 5 months on Australian radio where the discs that were on the major labels, they were banned from being played on Australian radio.
And then one man stepped up.
So what happened was there was a company called Fable Records run by a guy called Ron Tudor. They had just started up. They were not bound by the terms of this ban. In a brilliant piece of opportunism, he basically organized for local artists not signed by the big labels to record these overseas hits. They got played. Fable then became big. And actually, this was a period when there were a lot more Australian artists on the charts just because of things like Fable. In the summertime when the weather is fine. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That was an English song by a band called Mungo Jerry sent over here. The Mixtures recorded it. And it led to people having careers as a result of almost like a window opening up where all these big artists weren't being heard for 5 months on the radio. So quick, bring in the Aussie artists to do some of these songs. And it led to quite a few careers. So it was a very interesting time in Australian radio. You could say it was almost sort of like the precursor for kind of alternate artists being able to get into the charts.
More change was coming. In 1975, the ABC launched a youth station in Sydney with the call sign 2JJ, or Double J, which later went national and was renamed Triple J. Double J started pushing boundaries from the very beginning. DJ Holger Brockman launched the station with the first words, "Wow, we're away."
Wow, we're away. On behalf of all the team here at Double J, good morning and welcome. My name is Holger Brockman, formerly Bill Drake. Let's away.
And the Australian song no other station would play. Here's Joanna McMahon, a curator at the NFSA.
The first song that they broadcast was Skyhooks. You Just Like Me Because I'm Good in Bed, which was banned on commercial radio because it's, you know, because of like the content. And then they started, bang, first song, like, we're not like that, we're a public station, we can play what we want, we're youth oriented, we're like rock fueled. It's kind of that Australian homegrown music.
In the 70s, DJs started to lose some of their power, with TV shows like Countdown becoming more influential.
By the 70s, the DJ was less important than the music. The music got a bit more serious, the music industry got more serious and slicker. And so the DJs were still popular. They're always going to be popular DJs, but it was less about kind of their personality and more about the music that they were playing.
And when the mass-produced cassette recorder came along, anyone could play at being a DJ.
From the past, it brings back memories of listening to 3XY in the late 70s and later Barry Bissell's Take 40 Australia as a teenager in the 1980s.
Welcome back. I'm Barry Bissell and you're listening to Australia's 40 biggest hits on the nation's biggest countdown of the hits, Take 40 Australia.
Still to come on. Saturday night was the Australian Top 40 with Bissell. Sunday night was the American Top 40 with Casey Kasem and later Shadow Stevens. I'd have a 60 or a 90-minute cassette tape, so I'd be taping only the songs and bits that I wanted to re-listen to, not the entire programs, which also explains, I think, why a lot of material doesn't survive, because people didn't really want the bits in between. They just wanted the music and they wanted to re-listen to the music.
The game changed again when frequency modulation arrived. Never heard of it? You might know it as FM, a type of broadcasting that produced clearer, crisper sound than AM or amplitude modulation. Australia was slow to adopt FM. A small number of licences were handed out in the 70s to public and community broadcasters, but it wasn't until the beginning of the 80s that the commercial sector took notice, and by the end of that decade, the airwaves were dominated by the behemoths of Today FM, Triple M and Triple J. These stations featured plenty of music and charismatic drive-time announcers who became household names. Some made the move from TV, like Tony Martin and Mick Molloy of D-Generation and The Late Show.
We've had a lot of requests for the new version of the national anthem.
Oh, yeah.
In case you don't know what I'm talking about, over several months we assembled our seven wonders of Australia. You, the listeners, suggested them.
Gone were the days when TV poached radio's brightest stars. Now it was a two-way street. And once again, the boomers were in the right place at the right time. Now they were running the show, so they programmed what they wanted to hear, easy listening or nostalgia-based stations, and formats like Gold FM in Melbourne that played hit songs from the 60s and 70s. So where did that leave today's teenagers? Well, they turned to the stations where they could hear new and local music, community radio and Triple J.
You hear these great stories about people burning their own record or putting on a cassette and running to the radio station and putting it on immediately. Well, that has happened in Australia.
Fenella Kernebone has spent many years working in radio. From her origins in community radio and Triple J, she's currently the head of conference programming for South by Southwest Sydney.
I think the birth of our community radio stations and our national stations has enabled, particularly through time, for younger artists to get a chance to get their music out there to specific communities. I think Australia's access to this extraordinary community radio network, but also the fact that we have a really strong national ABC, Australian Broadcasting Corporation, plus also the youth network of Triple J, and the additional stations that are on top of that from SBS and beyond, has given us an incredible opportunity to create our own identity.
We'll be taking a close look at community radio in episode 5, but for now, it's worth noting that it helped launch some of our best loved artists, including Dan Sultan. Well, I walked in here off the dirty mile, swagging in with Courtney Barnett. And Gotye. Meanwhile, over at Triple J in 1989, staffer Laurie Zion came up with one of those basic but genius ideas, asking listeners to vote for their favourite song of all time. The winner of that first poll, which was called the Hot 100, was Joy Division with their song Love Will Tear Us Apart. And when the poll was held again the following year, they won again. And in 1993, after a year off, the poll got a new name, the Hottest 100, and a new rule. Only songs released in the last 12 months were eligible. Joy Division's run was over. It took another 4 years before listeners voted an Aussie band into the top spot, and that was Spiderbait with their song Buy Me a Pony. But then there was no stopping them. Four of the next 5 winners were Australian, including the Whitlams. Powderfinger. Powderfinger again. And Alex Lloyd. Very soon, people around the country were holding parties for the countdown, echoing the early days of communal radio listening.
I've been to many a Triple J Hottest 100 parties in my time where you're like listening all together. And that's like a kind of special part of it as a medium, I think.
In any given year, you wouldn't find much crossover between the acts on the Hottest 100 and the playlists of the big FM stations. Hierarchies of taste were already forming. Through it all, radio continued to provide the soundtrack to people's lives, as Lorna Clarkson recalls.
I think because of the era I was born in, radio was central to all family entertainment. It was basically what you tuned into to hear anything new. Like, you couldn't research music outside of radio. I remember as a really young child being in the car with my parents and my brother, and we would just be fighting over what music to listen to, like what radio station to tune into, because we were all music obsessed, dance music in the 90s. When there was no internet, when there was, you know, very little information and very little opportunity to hear music that you want to hear, it was the DJs that were playing the music on the radio stations that actually formed subcultures here in Sydney.
Lorna is one of the original members of Sydney's community radio station, FBI. She now works at Listener and hosts the Download Disco on 2SER. And she's been thinking about how the arrival of streaming platforms like Spotify and Apple Music has changed our relationship with music.
There's something quite special about parameters and imposed parameters. So I love that I have access to everything I ever want to listen to on streaming platforms, but it's also overwhelming. So when you've got access to absolutely every song that's ever been made, how do you then journey through that. It almost goes back to the days of record shops or radio stations in the early days where you actually need someone else to come and curate it for you.
Just as the transistor helped create teen culture, digital devices have cemented the idea of having your own personal soundtrack to life.
For me, I remember going on my first overseas trip as a 19-year-old, and I think CD Walkmans had just come out, and it was terrible. It skipped, like you had to hold it flat so it wouldn't skip the CDs, but I was so obsessed. I had to have CDs and I, you know, pack CDs to travel with. And I had to hold my Walkman in my hand flat as I walked around the streets of London to my own personal soundtrack. But that experience of soundtracking my own journey, like my own adventure, still sits with me. I think that kind of mobilization of music through technology is hugely important.
The music coming through the airwaves has influenced generations of listeners. But at the same time, another new radio format was also bringing big changes to society, and that was talkback.
Literally like Facebook Marketplace for radio, yeah.
In the next episode, we look at the rise of talkback radio, its evolution, and how you get people to broadcast their most intense feelings to total strangers.
I remember the morning after Princess Diana had died, and I just sort of sat there and fielded for hours and hours, just women absolutely distressed and so sad and all crying, and I was crying too.
This has been Who Listens to the Radio, brought to you by the National Film and Sound Archive. Thank you to our guests, Lorna Clarkson, Fenella Kernebone, and our NFSA curators, Torsten Kading, Simon Smith, and Joanna McMahon. And our science correspondent, Andy True. If you've enjoyed Who Listens to the Radio, don't forget to rate or review wherever you get your podcasts. You can visit the Radio 100 digital exhibition at www.nfsa.gov.au.